Welcome to this week's installment of Cultural Conversations. You can leave questions and comments at our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturalconversations. Rick, as a cultural anthropologist who studies food, can you describe to listeners the complexities of our relationships with food?
That's a great question. Like all complicated questions, it's got a complicated answer. But maybe the best way for me to explain it is to talk about the way food connects so many different things. Anthropologists are interested in all the different aspects of culture, from language to human evolution. And the amazing thing that food does is it connects very disparate parts of the human experience. So it connects fact and fiction. It connects the everyday experience of eating with the eternal questions about who we are and why we're here in the universe. It connects the past to the future. It's the substance of culture in a very real, everyday, tangible sense. So when you go and you visit people and you want to start talking about their culture, culture itself is invisible. It's a concept. And even language, people use it without really thinking about it. But food is tangible, and everybody is interested in it, and they like to talk about it. So everywhere I go as an anthropologist, I find food is a great place to start a conversation.
You know, and as an anthropologist myself, you know, I don't know if it's my professional or my personal interest, but when I, you know, a friend or family member has traveled abroad, my first question to them is, where did you eat? What was the food like?
Yes, and my mother was the same way. Whenever I went somewhere, I'd come back and she'd say, well, how did they feed you? You know, did you go hungry? And she would immediately cook me something. I think that connection of the personal to the professional is one of the things I value the most about anthropology, because it does kind of break down that boundary, and it shows us that, you know, as individuals, we're kind of the tool of our own research all the time. So in eating, we're learning.
Right. Now, speaking of research, what has, as an anthropologist who studies food and food relationships, what is your research focused on?
Well, I started as an archaeologist, so really what I was studying was food waste, you know, the broken dishes and broken pots and pans and things thrown away. But that work as an archaeologist took me to Central America and specifically to Belize back in the very early 1970s. And Belize turned out to be a fascinating place to me. So I've done a lot of research in Belize, particularly on why a country that's got such rich natural environment and soil, which will grow pretty much anything you can think of, why this country imports so much of its food. So this kind of, in explaining that, it led me to thinking and working on problems of globalization. And eventually those brought me around to sustainability. And now I've been working a lot on what the prospects are of building a food-producing system that's going to be sustainable in the long run when oil and cheap fossil fuels are gone.
Now, how about some of your research here in the U.S.? Can you share with listeners some of the things you've worked on?
Well, I started out doing work with a bunch of students when I lived in Santa Cruz, California, and we were studying cooperative housing where students live together. And we very quickly learned that you could tell everything you wanted to know about that household by looking in the refrigerator. If every item in the refrigerator had someone's name on it and dire warnings about what would happen if somebody ate this or drank that, it told you exactly how people were getting along household.
That's fascinating. And now I'm running through my mind what my refrigerator looks like right now and what story it tells.
I think all of us have some secrets in our refrigerator or our freezer somewhere. And later on, I did some research with a sociologist who was famous for finding 50 different uses for the refrigerator in the American family. My favorite was the family that took their credit cards and froze them in a bowl full of water, so that any time they were tempted to charge something, they would have to smash the ice and get the credit card out, and in doing so, they would have to think more about whether they really wanted to buy that thing.
Never in a million years would I have guessed.
More recently, I've gotten interested in Midwestern food. I've been living in Bloomington for 23 years now, raised my daughter as a Hoosier, and I got interested also, since I was writing a book about the history of Belize, I was just fascinated to find that there were these direct connections between Belize and southern Indiana in the 19th century. And actually, a lot of what was being eaten in Belize in the 19th century by crews of loggers out in the woods cutting mahogany was being produced here in southern Indiana, because southern Indiana was settled by people who were producing salt pork as one of their major sources of cash. So what people would do is they would let the hogs free in the woods in the fall to fatten up on the chestnuts and the hickory nuts and oak acorns. And then in October or November, they'd drive them down in these huge pig drives to the rivers, the White River and the Wabash and the Ohio, where there would be big slaughterhouses and rendering plants and carpentry sheds built, where they would make barrels. They'd bring in salt from nearby salt springs, and they would butcher the hogs and pack them in brine in these barrels. And then they would build flatboats, load the flatboats with barrels of salt pork, and basically ride them down the river to New Orleans, where they sold them. And then they walked back on a trail called the Natchez Trace, often after they had spent all their money in the Story District of New Orleans, having a really good time. And that salt pork was then traded all through the Caribbean and went as far as Brazil and South Africa. The only part of the hog that they couldn't salt because it was too soft was the tenderloin. The tenderloin doesn't salt very well. So apparently they gave the tenderloins away during this kind of fall butchering. And I think that's probably where the custom of eating pork tenderloins as a favorite food in the state of Indiana came from.
You find it at most fairs and festivals. And, you know, up here in Fort Wayne, we have one festival after another. This is festival season every summer. And, you know, I think the pork tenderloin there's always a stand or two that they're selling these pork tenderloins, as well as all other kinds of festival foods. And so I'm going to move us away from the pork tenderloin and just kind of pick your brain a bit, how you feel about festival foods. You know, I have a lot of folks who are so excited they had their first deep-fried Oreo or first deep-fried Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. And I know some folks have eaten deep-fried butter sticks, which I just can't even imagine. how do you
fried
feel about
Coke.
Festival foods? How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I think in the last 30 or 40 years, if you wanted to pick something out that really characterized American food, I would say that American food is fun. I call this nutritainment. It's kind of the mixture of play and entertainment with food. I mean, when I was a little kid, we got penny candy, and you'd spend an hour picking these little dots of candy off a roll of tape. Or there would be little guns made out of candy or candy cigarettes. And we're always told not to play with our food, but we do. And if you go in the grocery store, when I was a kid, most food was packaged in, you know, brown paper or relatively plain wrappers. Now you go in the store and the stuff is packaged as if it was toys. You know, everything is bright colors and, you know, and there's pictures of Snap, Crackle, and Pop and elves and, you know, all kinds of fanciful figures. And you walk down the cereal aisle and it's like you're being attacked by a mob of cartoon characters. And I think that's become kind of for all ages. So when we go to a fair or we go to a carnival or we go to, you know, any kind of special event, we expect to see something like a fountain of chocolate or something improbable like Coca-Cola deep fried. And we expect it to be entertaining and fun. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. I like the idea of playing with food. But it worries me because things that are fun when you do them once or twice a year, there's always a temptation then to start having them five or six times a year. And in fact, this is the way that cuisines change, one of the most important ways they change. For instance, in Belize, where I work right now, the favorite food is rice and beans with stewed chicken. When I started working there in the 1970s, that was a dish people ate on Sundays, and it was a special treat because chicken was expensive. Now chicken is cheaper, and people eat rice and beans and stewed chicken 5 or 6 days a week. Everywhere you go, it's rice and beans and stewed chicken to the point where I find it pretty boring. It's very easy for these kind of high-calorie fun foods to go from being an occasional entertainment to being part of the diet. You know, oh, well, let's have deep-fried Snickers at Christmas. And I think that by making food a form of entertainment, we also kind of miss out on some of the other parts of the food experience, you know, which are bringing people together to enjoy something a little bit more spiritual than sharing a stick of fried butter.
Thank you for listening to Cultural Conversations, edited by Sarah DeLea and Blake Lau. Join me every Thursday for a new installment of the podcast at nipr.fm to learn more about this beautiful human mosaic. You can leave questions and comments at our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturalconversations.